then recall your motivation. Have a big mind of bodhicitta that thinks expansively. So in the discussion group that we just had, we were talking about what we would like to do with our lives before we die and what unfinished business we have and what we want to clear up so that we don't have regrets when we die. And so people were saying that they realize that they're very slow moving in this area in terms of doing what they want to do that they find really important in their life, and that they spend a lot of time worrying about getting attached to feeling resentful of things that are really not very significant when we think in the big picture. And yet at the moment, our mind gets completely sunk in that stuff, and they look like a national disaster. Mm. Okay, so sometimes when you, and we hear that meditating on death and impermanence is the antidote to do that. And so sometimes when we do that, then we say, okay, I've got to really change quickly. Like it says, you know, quickly, I better change quickly and do everything quickly. And we get just a little bit tight and tense because we tend to be very goal-oriented, you know. It's like, oh, okay, I realize that I've been being a bit lazy, but so now I have to accomplish everything by Saturday. yeah, and we get tense and tight. So it's very important, you know, in our Dharma practice that we pace ourselves, that we have huge aspirations, but we don't become self-critical and dissatisfied because we're unable to fulfill all of our aspirations immediately. Rather, we develop a sense of satisfaction from making the effort to go in that direction. Okay? And I say that because if we become very goal-oriented and get very tight, that actually becomes an impediment to developing the qualities that we're trying to develop. Okay? And so that's why I was saying when we think of things that we might want to do before we die, yeah, we have some of those things. We can start doing them. We may not finish them. Death may come first. But at the time of death, we don't have to regret not having completed those things, because instead we can rejoice that we made the effort and got as much accomplished as we did. Okay? So, for example, you know, one of my aims is to build the Abbey. Not just physically, but in terms of the Dharma, in terms of the monastic community. Now, do I have any control all by myself over how that's going to happen? No. It depends on the karma of a lot of different people. So from my side, I have to do what I can in going towards this direction, which is one of my aims. But how far along it gets, I have to accept. Also, because I don't know how long I'm going to live. Okay? So the thing to do is to do what we can with integrity and consistency, but not be so goal-oriented that we're constantly dissatisfied and self-critical. Okay? Because that's really important. really important.
Yeah.
Because if we get dissatisfied and self-critical, it's usually because our understanding of death and impermanence is intellectual. And we're telling ourselves, I should. Okay? So we're shoulding on ourselves. Yeah? Which is not very helpful. Okay? So we want to really ease our way into this meditation and know that as we understand it deeply and correctly, it will create not a sense of panic, okay, but a sense of focus, direction, and meaning and purpose in our life. Okay? So I say this just so people can use it as a litmus test to make sure that you're coming out with the correct conclusion of the meditation. Because lots of times we can hear the points, meditate, come out with what sounds verbally like the right conclusion, but you can tell by the texture and tone of our mind that it's not the right conclusion. Okay, communicating? Okay. So now we're going to get into the actual meditation on death that in the Tibetan tradition, they made it into a 9-point meditation. So there's 3 general big points, and each big point has 3 smaller points. Okay? So the 3 main points are 1, that death is definite, it's certain to happen. 2, the time of death is not certain, it's indefinite. And 3, what comes with us to the next life is our karma and our mental habits. Okay, so those are the 3 big points, and each one has a conclusion, but I'll tell you the conclusion after we go through the 3 sub-points for each main point. Okay, so the main point of death is definite, then the first sub-point of that is that everybody dies, and there's no way not to die. So even if you look at the great spiritual leaders, people who were incredibly well-respected, even people who were very powerful in terms of financial power, political power, people who were famous because of their artistic or musical ability or athletic ability, everybody we can think of, whether they're high status or low status in terms of societal status, everybody dies. So they say death is the great equalizer. Yeah, because it doesn't matter who you are, there's no way to avoid it. And so when you meditate on that, you just sit there with this fact that everybody dies. No, there's no way to avoid it. There's nowhere we can go where we're not going to die. There's no authority we can appeal to so that we don't die. That death is just a natural thing. And I think here it's also helpful to think that not only we will die, but all the other people we know will die. And to familiarize our mind with the idea that our friends and relatives will die, that our loved ones will die, that the people we depend on in life also are not going to live forever, and we don't really know who's going to die first. But to get used to the fact that separation will occur from our dear ones. Okay? And it's very natural. It is part of life. Yeah? Now, we might have our own little rules, like old people die before young people, but that doesn't matter because death comes when it's going to come, regardless of our little rules. Okay, and nobody can avoid it. Okay, then the second point about death is that our lifespan cannot be extended. Okay, that we are born with a certain maximum lifespan, And we know that, you know, people on our planet, well, we know, for example, in 100 years, none of us are going to be here. Yeah? Okay, so in 2110, none of us are going to be here. We know that. Okay? And there's no way to counteract that. You know, it's just a fact that this world is going to go on without us in whatever form it goes on in. Okay? We sometimes tend to think that if we aren't here, everything's going to fall apart, but actually it continues. Okay? And then the third subpoint is that we will die even if we haven't had a chance to practice the Dharma. Okay? And so this is important because sometimes when we have this feeling of, you know, I'll practice later, I'll transform my mind later, I'll purify later, then we feel that until we do those things, we're not going to die. Yeah, but that doesn't make any sense. Okay, and in fact, our whole life can go by with our saying every day, mañana, mañana, mañana. Okay, so, you know, we can't just think that delaying our practice is going to be a safeguard against death. Yeah. Okay. So when the conclusion we draw, you know, from meditating on these three points is that, you know, death is definite. It's certain to happen. Therefore, it's important for me to practice the Dharma. And remember, when I say practice the Dharma, I'm not talking necessarily be about prostrations and offerings and, you know, reading things and stuff like that, chanting mantra. I'm talking about at the actual process of transforming our mind. Doing all those formal practices are methods to transform our mind. But the actual Dharma practice is the transformation. Okay? So releasing anger, releasing craving, generating love and wisdom, and so on. Okay? So we conclude that because death is definite, because everybody dies, there's no way to extend our life, and death is going to happen whether we practice or not, that therefore practicing is important. Okay? Then the second main point is that the time of death is indefinite. Okay, so once we kind of get it that we're going to die and that the people we care about are going to die, then, you know, to think that the time of death is indefinite. And so there's three subpoints under that. And the first one is that the duration of our life is basically uncertain and we're always going to be in the middle of doing something when we die. Okay, yeah, everybody dies in the middle of doing something. Okay, because we sometimes think, well, I'll do this and I'll do this and I'll do this and I'll do this, and then when I have all that accomplished, then I'll die. Okay, there was a friend of mine when I was in college, and he had his whole life planned out, you know, like 4 years of undergrad and 4 years of medical school and 4 years of residency, and then he's going to do this, and then, you know, kind of then he's going to get married by this age and have his 2.5 kids by that age, and this and that. Had it all planned out, and then, you know, die when it's all complete. But, you know, we can have all the plans we want, but it doesn't mean anything. Yeah. Because the time of our death is indefinite and we're always going to be in the middle of doing something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So some people sit down for a meal and before they can finish the meal, they've had a heart attack, they've had a stroke, they've choked on something. Okay. People set out on a journey, they set out to go to work, before they can arrive at work, they're in a car accident. They never get there. Yeah. I had one of my friends. This was in the days when they had records and record players. It was her sister-in-law, I think it was, who was doing belly dancing in the house and was practicing belly dancing, and her husband was in the other room, and the record reached the end. She was a young woman, and just kept going round and around and around, and eventually the husband was wondering what was going on, went in there, and she had had some kind of, I don't know, stroke or aneurysm or something, and in her 20s died. Yeah? So there was recently, I think, one famous, very famous baseball star who died from a stroke or something like that. You know, people are always in the middle of doing something, dying, you know? Even if we all think we're going to, like, get old and then get weak or get sick and then it's going to be this long process. But even if it's like that, still, you know, you're in the middle of breathing in or breathing out and you die. You're still in the middle of doing something, okay? But then there's so many people who die when, you know, they're just doing regular activities in their life. And I'm sure if we sat down and went in a circle, everybody knows somebody that this kind of thing happened to. You know, you hear a story of someone who was well one day and not there the next day. Yeah. And then the second point under that, the thing that the time of death is indefinite, is that it takes a lot of energy to stay alive and very little energy to die. Okay? So if you look at it, if we really were lazy and did nothing, then naturally our body would die of starvation or dehydration or cold or heat or something like that. Yeah? So we actually have to put in a tremendous amount of energy to keep this body alive. We have to feed it, and think of how much time you spend in your life, not just cooking and eating and cleaning up, that already takes a lot of time, but you have to go to the store to buy the food, you have to earn the money to buy the food, you have to get the kind of clothes and drive the kind of car so you can go to that job to earn the money to buy the food. You know, so when you think of what it takes to keep this body alive and nourished, to keep a roof over our head, to keep clothes, to get medicine, you know, it's an all-consuming task in our life. And if we didn't do any of it, the body would naturally pass away. Yeah. So, I mean, really think about it, and it could be very helpful, you know, thinking of how many hours a day you spend taking care of this body. Okay. Well, first of all, how many hours do you spend sleeping? Cross that off, you know, got to take care of the body doing that for however many hours you have to sleep. And then think about the food thing. Think about what you have to do to get shelter, what you have to do to get clothes, and what you have to do to get medicine, and how much time and energy you have to take, you know, to exercise this body and to learn about healthy eating and to make sure you eat healthy and this and that, okay? And yet this body, by its very nature, is disintegrating, and it takes a lot of energy to keep it alive and no energy at all for it to die. Then the third point under this one, that death is the time of death is indefinite, is that the body itself is not so strong. Yeah. Now, we feel very strong and we feel very vibrant. Okay, but, you know, a small little virus that we can't even see can be our demise. A tiny bacteria can, you know, can enter our body and kill us. You know, stepping on a rusty nail, stepping, you know, a piece of metal, you know, in the wrong place in our body, just small things can have catastrophic results in terms of our ability to live. Okay? And so when you think about that, you realize that the body itself, you know, is quite vulnerable. So thinking about this should not create a sense of obsession with our body and keeping it healthy. Okay? So don't meditate on this point and then start worrying about your health and become more obsessed than you already are about, you know, keeping your body healthy. But we do what we can to keep the body healthy and keep it clean. But we meditate on this point so that we get the point that the nature of our body is that it is changing and getting older and passing away, and that it's not that strong. Okay? So this is especially effective when you're young and you feel invulnerable. Okay? Remember how when you're young, you feel like definitely death doesn't happen to me. It happens to other people. You know? And all these people warning me to be careful, they're so stupid and so worried and so overprotective, and they don't have a clue what life is about. Right? Remember? And then, sometimes as you age, you realize that your parents actually knew something. You know, they weren't quite as dumb as you thought they were. yeah? And the big thing is that you have experiences and you watch your own friends die when they're young. And one thing that I often do when I'm in retreat is I make a list of all the people I've known who have died. You know? And it doesn't seem like very many when I start out, but as I go on, it's more and more and more and more. And living here at the Abbey, we get so many calls and emails each week to please pray for different people who have died. Are in the process of dying. Okay, and they come in all ages. So it's very helpful sometimes, you know, to be in a cemetery and go and read the plaques and see how long those people lived, you know, and you see that there's some that were just 2 or 3 years old, and you don't know what these kids died of. You know, if it was an illness, if it was an injury, you know. Then you see teenagers, you know, people only live to be 14, 15. You know, and then people only live to be in their 20s, yeah, or in their 30s. And you see all different ages on the tombstones. So this whole idea that we have that, you know, for sure, okay, maybe death is definite, but it's a long way off. We can begin to see that that is not realistic and that death could come very quickly. Very soon. We have no idea. Because it doesn't even depend on being sick. You can be very healthy and dead the next day. Okay. So the conclusion that we draw from contemplating that the time of death is indefinite, yeah, because there's no fixed lifespan and we're always in the middle of doing things, because it takes a lot to stay alive and no energy to die, because our body is not so strong and invulnerable, the conclusion we draw is that therefore not only is practicing Dharma important, but practicing it now is important. Because when we see that the time of death is indefinite, then we know the only time we have to practice to transform our mind is now. There's no guarantee of the next moment. So, sometimes our mind is very funny And we can spend a whole meditation session or even a whole retreat planning all the Dharma practice we're going to do in the future. Okay? Everybody done it? Yeah. And you plan, oh, I'm going to go here, I'm going to study this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to do this retreat and get that initiation, do this practice and go do this and go do that and da da da. And our whole grandiose plans of all these things we're going to do to practice the Dharma. But in the meantime, this very moment, when we have to actually transform our mind, we're not. We're lost in our daydreams. So it's very important to really keep our mind, you know, focused. We don't just, we only can live in the present. We can't live in the past because it's already over. We can't live in the future because it's already happened. That doesn't mean we don't think of the past and future. Those things exist. But we become aware that the only time we're ever living, thus the only time we ever have to practice, is in this very moment. Okay? So we often have the things of, well, I'm just kind of biding time, but when I go and do retreat, then I'll be really practicing. Then you go and do retreat, and while you're in a retreat, you think, oh, there's all these people who are out there actually helping others and living with bodhicitta. I should go do that. You know, I'm just wasting my time here in retreat. I should go do something for others. So you leave retreat, and then you go and you, you know, run a soup kitchen or you do something to help others. Then, in the middle of that, you think, well, that's okay, but, you know, I really need to study the Dharma. I don't know very much Dharma, and I can't practice without knowing it. So I better leave aside my societal project, my projects to benefit society, and I better go study the Dharma. So you go and do that, and then you start studying. And then while you're studying, you say, oh, I'm just studying. It's all intellectual. I need to meditate more. I need to go and retreat. So you leave your studies and you go and retreat. And so the cycle of dissatisfaction continues. Okay? With the mind always thinking that the best Dharma practice, yeah, is on the other side of the meditation hall, you know? Yeah, but somehow what I'm doing is not good enough. I'm being lazy, I'm being slack, I need to do something else, you know? So I need to do retreat, or I need to study, or I need to do social engaged projects. I need to switch my life in order to start practicing the Dharma. Wrong. Okay? What we need to change is that dissatisfied mind. Okay? That's what we need to change, is that dissatisfied mind. And we need to practice in whatever situation that we're in at the moment. Because, you know, sometimes we cannot control the situation we're in, can we? Or sometimes we might have great dreams of something we're going to do, but we really don't have the basic causes to be able to do it well. Yeah? So it would be more beneficial for us to create the basic causes than to go and try and do our extravagant plan. Yeah. So we need to be very practical. And, you know, whoever is in front of our nose at any particular moment, that's the person that we practice love and compassion for, you know, with. Or that's the person that we think, without this person, I can't generate bodhicitta. And without bodhicitta, I can't become enlightened. Yeah. So it doesn't matter where you are, what you're doing. The thing is, whatever is in front of us becomes our practice. Because if we don't do that, then we live in a perpetual state of dissatisfaction, no matter what we're doing. And we always feel that our practice isn't good enough. And so we get into that whole dynamic of beating ourselves up and being impatient to have results. Okay? So better just, you know, wherever we are, we practice. I remember so clearly at the beginning of my practice, being in Nepal, and, you know, people would come up the hill, these new people, and we would have to greet them. I worked in the office, and so I was greeting them. And they would chat and, you know, have tea and everything. And I'm thinking, why don't they be quiet? I want to go meditate on compassion. You know, it's like they're wasting my time when I could be meditating on compassion. You know, why did my teacher tell me to do this job of working in the office, serving these people tea and doing this anyway? I don't want to do it. You know, I want to meditate on compassion. So basically, you see, wasting my time. So, wherever we're at, we use that opportunity, okay? Then the third point is that at the time of death, what is important is, or are, the karmic seeds that we've accumulated, that we take with us, and our mental habits, you know, the different imprints and latencies on our mind through what we've done in our life. Now, what interferes with us creating good karma and building up and strengthening our love and compassion and wisdom? And what interferes with us really understanding impermanence or emptiness? Okay. The basic thing that interferes with our Dharma practice is attachment. And there's three things that we're principally attached to, okay? Material possessions and money, friends and relatives, and our body. And yet, at the time of death, none of these three come with us. And instead, everything we've had to do to get them, to procure them and protect them, has created karma. And since our mind was motivated by attachment to procure and protect these things, then the karma gets involved with lying and stealing and deception and so on and so on. So we have a ton of negative karmic seeds. And yet the things that we were working so hard to procure and protect stay here while our mind string goes on to the next life. Okay, so we take material possessions and money. You know, some people, you know, well, all of us have a certain amount of attachment for these things, but some people really attached. You know, the meaning of my life is having money and possessions. That's how I measure that my life is successful, is that I have a lot of material things. And so you work very hard. Sometimes you fudge things so you can get more money. Yeah. Sometimes you might speak badly about one colleague so that to your boss so that you can get the promotion, so that you can get more status or more money. You know. Sometimes you fudge on your time charts. I mean, there's all sorts of things that we do to get more money and more possessions. We drop hints, we borrow things and don't return them. Okay, we run up a huge credit card bill and don't pay it off. There's lots of things that we do out of this kind of attachment. And so we accumulate a lot of negative karma, and that negative karma comes with us to the future life. But at the time we die, our material possessions and our money all stay here. Not one penny goes with us. Okay? Now, in some cultures, they have the custom of putting money and possessions in the coffin. That's very nice, but none of it goes with. Okay, it just rots in the coffin. You know, in some cultures that do ancestor worship, they have huge paper things, you know. When I lived in Singapore, It's not so prominent now, but it still happens. But it was very prominent when I first went there. You know, piles of banknotes from the Bank of Hell that you burn for your dead relatives so that they will have it in their next life. And, you know, paper houses, paper computers, paper cars, incredible things that out of a feeling of filial piety and love, you burn, thinking that then the deceased can take those things with them in their future life. Okay? Now, we all know that when babies are born, they don't come in with anything, do they? Except their karma. They don't have clothes. They don't have a bank account. They have nothing. Yeah. So all those things from the previous life that, you know, the relatives tried to get to accompany us to this life, none of that happened. Okay. And what did come with us is the seeds of the negative karma that we did from trying to get all that material property. And then, you know, then the money and the possessions also become the basis for our miserliness, don't they? And our fear and our stinginess, and if I give it away, I won't have it, and what happens if I need it? You know? And so all these kind of very tight mental states that create not very good karma is involved in procuring and protecting wealth. And the wealth doesn't come with us, but the karma does. Okay? So in fact, at the time of death, all the wealth stays here. Other people are going to go through your closets. You know, now the idea of somebody going through your closet and, you know, do you want other people looking in your closets and your drawers? No, this is my stuff. And what are they going to find out about me, you know, when they look through my closets and my drawers and they look in my old diaries and, you know. Well, somebody's going to do this at some point, aren't they? Because we've left a huge mess. And somebody's going to have to clean it up. Yeah. And that huge mess consists of a lot of things that we actually could have used to create positive karma by being generous and sharing them and giving them away. Okay? So all this stuff in our closet that we're hanging on to for dear life, if we give it away, generosity, you know, especially with a motivation of kindness, creates so much good karma. And we say that, but we don't live like we believe in it, because we hold on to this stuff with incredible fear and anxiety that if we give it away, we won't have it. So, yeah. So meditating on this, the fact that none of this stuff comes with us, and you know, what's going to happen to all your stuff? People are going to go through it. They're going to give it away. Your precious t-shirt that is a grand memory of this wonderful vacation you took is going to go to the Salvation Army, and nobody's going to know its important value. And in fact, they might even throw it away and use it as a rag. Yeah? I mean, it's true, isn't it? The things that we hang on to that have so much sentimental value that other people look at and say, what kind of junk is this? Yeah? And yet we can't bear to separate from it.
It's always good when we do it at the Abbey here is to have another community member watch us go through our stuff and have a much more objective viewpoint of what we're...
Yeah. Throw that away. No! I thought you were a renunciate. I am, but not a bat. So, you know, we just cling so much. And then our relatives fight over all the money and possessions, don't they? You know, we could have used all these things to create so much positive karma by giving them away, but we didn't. And then what's left is that, you know, people are contesting the will, and this relative says, I want this, and the other one says, no, I want it. And they say, oh, in the will it means this. Oh, no, they had another will. It happens, doesn't it? It happens a lot to families that you wouldn't think it would happen to. My parents tell me, you know, were telling me stories of what happens to their friends, you know, what their friends' kids do, you know, when somebody dies and the awful things they do, kind of as a mild way of telling us, don't you kids do that? But, you know, it's amazing what happens in families. Yeah. All over, you know, who gets this bedspread? And who gets the jewelry? And who gets these pieces of paper with green ink on them? Yeah? Quite amazing. Okay? So, wealth and money doesn't come with us. So it's not a very good object to take refuge in and spend a lot of time worrying about. We need a certain amount of wealth to be able to stay alive, but after that, it's better to use it to create some good karma. Then what about our friends and relatives? Okay, we take refuge in them. Okay, wealth's not so important, but friends and relatives really are. You know, and I don't want to separate from them. And these relationships are so important, and these people make me feel so good, and I need them, and they need me. Yeah. And yet, at the time of death, there's no choice, is there? Absolutely no choice. It does not matter how much you love somebody. When death is there, you have to separate. Yeah. Doesn't matter how many years you've spent together. It doesn't matter how closely related you are. You know, the time of death arrives and there's separation. And in your next life, you're not even going to remember this person. And you may not even meet that person again for thousands of eons, depending upon where you've been born and where they've been born. And yet, so often people die clinging onto their friends and relatives, not wanting to die. You know, thinking that, you know, the family can't exist without me. Everything's going to fall apart. Well, but there's no choice. You know, when we die, there's no choice. Okay? And so these people who we're just with temporarily now this life, we get so attached to. You know, so incredibly attached. I love you. I miss you. I don't want to separate from you. You know, and we also get very angry at them. The people, you know, that we're closest to, we get the angriest at. Yeah. And so we create all this incredible karma on the basis of friends and relatives. And yet at the time of death, you know, we separate. And, you know, we go on to our next life. So we don't look anything like we look now. They're not going to recognize us. They go on to their next life. They don't look anything like they look now. You know? If your loved one died and got incarnate, you know, got reborn as the neighbor's kid across the street, are you going to recognize them? No. You're going to tell your neighbors, your baby cries so much. Make him be quiet. You're not going to think, oh, that was my dear loved one. There's this great story. I won't get all the details right, but I'll get the main point right. Of when Shariputra and Moggallana, the Buddha's two chief disciples, when they were on alms round one day, and they, you know, they come with their alms bowl, and then the people give them food. And they looked in the house, and in the house there was, let's see, there was the father who was holding the baby, his baby, on his lap, and the mother who was feeding fish to the dog, because they had a pond in the back of their house, and the husband used to catch the fish, which she was feeding to the dog. And Shariputra Mogliana went, oh, samsara is just too much. Because they had the clairvoyant powers to see, okay, that the fish and the dog were the woman's parents before they died. Okay? So her mother and father were now the dog and the fish. Okay? So her father was the fish, the mother was the dog. So, you know, of this couple, the wife is now eating the husband, you know, in their next lives. Fed and encouraged by the daughter who was feeding them. And the man is bouncing this baby on his lap, and the baby is the future life, the next life of his wife's lover that he was tremendously jealous over, but has now been born their baby who he loves so much. Okay? So when you think about this, that, you know, whoever we think is so dear and precious now, next life, we have no idea what kind of relationship we're going to have with them. So what's the use of being so attached to these people right now? Yeah? What use is it, you know, just so attached? Oh, they're my family. They're so meaningful. They're so important. They're so, and I don't want to separate. And, you know, and then, of course, getting really angry at them because they don't want to do what you want them to do. Okay, but what's the use of that, considering that when we die, what all we take with us is all the karma we accumulated from this icky gooey attachment and everything we did to, you know, get them to like us and everything we did to help them, you know, whatever negative karma, maybe we stole to give them a present or whatever. All that comes with us is the negative karma and the mental habits of attachment and resentment. Yeah, but the people still are here. Okay, so we're not saying what use is having human relationships. I'm not saying that. I'm saying what use is being attached to people. What use is being upset with them? That's what I'm saying. Okay, we're practicing the bodhisattva path. Other living beings are important to us, but it, being attached to them is not important, and resenting them is not important. Okay, and then our body, our wealth, our friends and relatives, then our body. Our body also doesn't come with us at death. Yeah. Let me go back to the friends and relatives for a minute. The friends and relatives may all be around your bed, sobbing when you're dying, saying, I love you, don't die. Can they prevent you from dying? Nothing. In fact, their sobbing and their clinging at the time of death is likely to be really agitating to your mind. Then our body, you know, our body has been with us 24/7. Yeah, all the time we're with this body. But this body deserts us at the time of death. So this body that we've taken such good care of, that we pamper so much, you know, this body that we've given up Dharma practice for in order to take care of, because we do, don't we? You know, very often my body is more important than my Dharma practice. Take care of my body first. Yeah, then comes Dharma practice. Now, of course, if you're sick, you have to take care of your body, but you can do it with a good motivation, and you can still practice while you're sick. So I'm talking about this mind of incredible attachment that just gives up everything, you know, because we're so obsessed with our body. And this body is the great betrayer, isn't it? It gets old on us. It gets sick on us. And it dies. And yet, we treat it like this incredible, like our best friend. We give it so much pleasure. Every tiny, itty-bitty thing we can do to give our body pleasure, we do. Yeah? And so we create a lot of negative karma. We waste a lot of time just, you know, giving this body pleasure. So I am not saying neglect your body. I am not saying abuse your body. Okay? What I'm saying is it doesn't make any sense to be obsessed and attached to this body. We have to keep it healthy. We have to keep it clean with a good motivation to benefit sentient beings. But beyond that, indulging the pleasures of this body is not worth much because none of that pleasure lasts very long, does it? Does it? Doesn't last very long at all. You know, we do so many things to give this body pleasure. How long do they last? Yeah, this long. Okay? You know, it's like, oh, I want to eat dinner, I want to eat dinner. How long does it take you to eat dinner? And then it's over. Yeah? Or sex, how long does it take for that? Not very long. Yeah. Or sleeping, okay, it takes a little bit longer, but you aren't even awake to enjoy it. So what kind of pleasure does sleeping give us? Yeah? So, you know, this kind of, and especially nowadays, how obsessed we are with our body, you know, and how society really encourages that. And we grow up to feel that our body isn't good enough and we need to do something extra to make our body more attractive. And it's all rubbish. And we get really quite psychologically unhealthy. And you see this in kids now because of all the advertising. You know, what they think they're supposed to be when they're really little, and they get really kind of scared and neurotic about it. Okay, so when we contemplate this, that, you know, at the time of death, our wealth, our friends and relatives, our body don't come with us, that only our karma and our mental habits come with us, then the conclusion we draw from that is, therefore, I have to practice purely. Okay, so I have to really have a good motivation and not let my mind get distracted by attachment and worry about wealth, relationships, and my body. Okay, so we take care of those things. They all have a place in our life, but we don't get distracted by attachment and obsession with them. Okay. So that's the 9-point death meditation. When you do it and you go through each point and really think about it well, you know, at the end you come out with a strong feeling of, okay, you know, my life has meaning and it has purpose because my consciousness is going to continue on after this life, and what it's going to continue on as and what I experience is going to be a result of how I use my time and energy now. Yeah, and I have a precious human life, and I have the potential to become a fully enlightened Buddha, and so I want to put my time and energy towards practicing the path so I can have a good rebirth, so I can attain liberation, so I can become a Buddha, because those kinds of goals are much more valuable than all the tiny things that I get so upset about on a daily basis. Okay? And so when you really meditate on death and impermanence in this way, your mind gets very peaceful. Yeah? Your mind is not agitated at all, because all the things that you used to get so agitated about, you realize are rather silly, and you let them go. There was one time when I was living in Dharamsala, and my teacher Geshe Nalandarge was teaching from Aryadeva's 400 stanzas. And there's a whole chapter in there about death and impermanence. And so we would go every afternoon. It was just a small group of us, and Geshe was teaching this. And then I'd come back to my room and I'd do the meditation on exactly what he taught that day. And during that time, my mind got so peaceful. It was amazing. I lived next door to this person who used to play her radio really loud. It stopped bothering me. I didn't care about her radio anymore. You know? It was like, I don't have the energy to and the time to get agitated because she plays her radio too loud. And then all these little things, you know, so-and-so doesn't like me. I don't have time to worry about that. So-and-so doesn't agree with my ideas. Oh, that's okay. You know, so-and-so criticized me. Okay. You know, it's like the ability to let things go becomes so much easier because you see that those things are not the meaning and purpose of my life. Yeah, that the meaning and purpose of my life is, you know, to transform my mind and be of benefit to sentient beings. And when my mind is stuck in the small stupidagios, you know, it's so limited. I'm not fulfilling my meaning and purpose. Because what's happened is I've lost perspective. And those small things that are only issues of this life, I've forgotten they're only issues of this life, and I've started thinking that they are national catastrophes, you know, and that I can't live without getting this thing resolved and correcting the way this person behaved towards me. You know how that is? I can't stand the way this person treats me, and they do this and they do that, and I'm so unhappy and on and on. I've got to talk to them, and I've got to lay down the law, and I've got to set boundaries, and I've got to, you know, stop them when they're doing this, and I've got to, and I've got to, and I've got to. Yeah, and we're so miserable, aren't we? So miserable. And can we control what that other person does? You can set all the boundaries you want. Can you control their actions? No. The only thing we can control is our own mind. But we're too busy blaming the other people to work with our own mind. And we're too busy stewing in our own juice to work with our mind. Okay? So when we really do this meditation and think, you know, what's the meaning and purpose of my life? You know, even if this person, you know, came up every morning to me and made 3 prostrations and said, "You're the most wonderful thing in the world," are you going to be happy? You know, your worst enemy that you obsess on in each meditation session, all of a sudden, you know, makes 3 prostrations and sincerely says, "You are wonderful." Are you going to live happily ever after? No. So why are you trying to get them to do that? Why are we wasting our time and energy on that? Okay. So you see, this is the benefit of really thinking deeply, is that about impermanence and death, is that it puts the events of our life into a healthy perspective so that we can actually see what is important and what is not important. Okay? Ethical issues are important. Why I do the things I do, that is very important. Because that's going to influence the karma I create. That's going to influence whether I'm creating the cause for liberation and enlightenment or not. Okay, so why I do what I do and what my mental state is at any particular moment is very important. Whether everything goes the way I want it to go, that's not so important. In fact, we should assume in life that things are not going to go the way we want them to go. Because we have lots of unrealistic expectations. So I'm not saying be pessimistic, but I'm saying let's not be attached to all of our daydreams and expectations. Yeah, let's just live our life in an ethical, kind way and put some wisdom in there moment to moment. And the expectations, you know, they'll figure themselves out. Questions? Yeah.
General, could you talk about the use of extreme measures to prolong life particularly medical research.
Okay. So extreme measures to extend life, particularly, are you talking about like the way our country is using a lot of its resources to develop measures that extend life for a certain number of people? When you said medical research?
Is that interfering with the natural flow of death?
Okay. Okay. Okay, so now I understand your question. So are medical procedures interfering with the flow, you know, of death? I think, life is very precious, and if it's possible to extend somebody's lifespan so that they can make use of their life, you know, by practicing, and you can do wonderful things with your mind even when you're sick in bed. You don't have to sit in meditation position. Okay? So to extend the life, I think, you know, because life is precious, is very good, you know. To extend, to use extreme measures that extend life simply because there's fear of death, that, I think, is where we have to question. Okay? Because, and it depends upon somebody's level of practice, but I think some people would rather than go through a lot of extreme measures, like, let's say, what's it called when they're thumping your chest? CPR? Okay, so some people might be quite ill and say no code because they realize that they're close to death anyway, and they would much rather not have invasive procedures going on when they're dying so that the elements and the mind, you know, can die naturally and the elements can absorb in a gradual process without this external disturbance. Yeah, because when you're dying, you know, if they're pounding on your chest and so on, you may not know, oh, they're trying to keep me alive, they're being kind. You may feel like, you know, people are assaulting you, yeah, because you're half out of it, yeah. And so that could be interfere with the death process, yeah. So there's, you know, in some situations, I think people would rather just have death be natural so that the elements can absorb, you know, you can do what you need to do and just die naturally without all sorts of things going on around you. Yeah. That may or may not prolong your life. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How about pain medication?
Okay, pain medication. I think it's going to depend a lot on the person. And a lot of times it's possible for people to have pain medication and it doesn't cloud the mind that much. You know, if you have a skillful physician, you can have enough medication so that the pain is taken care of but your mind is not clouded. Yeah, that's possible. With people who don't practice the Dharma, the clarity of mind, it's not, you know, they're not going to really know what to do at death anyway, how to guide their own mind. With people who do practice, you know, you see what they want. Because for some people, if they're in too much pain, they can't practice. They can't guide their mind. Yeah? So, you know, everybody's going to be really individual on this. And some people, even people who don't practice, if they're in too much pain, they can't guide their mind. They need some pain medication. Yeah, or they can't just be peaceful because they're in too much pain. So I think you have to see what the individual wants.
Thank you. Is the nature of karma such that it only ripens in the next life, or can it happen? Now.
Okay, so does karma only ripen in your next life, or can it ripen now? It can ripen now. Yeah. And very often, the karma that ripens now is often karma that's very strong. So it ripens quickly, ripens soon.
Just a piggyback question. One of the very popular things that we do with hospice patients right at the time of death, or if they're very close, they're intimately dying, we invite families or loved ones to bring in favorite music, favorite scents, you know. So we're kind of re-engaging the senses for these people, and I've often thought, you know, are we doing a service, which it looks good on that, but are we keeping them there and doing that?
Okay, so in hospice, one thing that they do is when the person is imminently dying, they have the family bring in their favorite music, their favorite perfume, their favorite whatever things, and so the people are being forced to re-engage their senses, and is that really benefiting them? I don't think so. Yeah, I think that is tying them more in this life and distracting them, because, you know, when people are dying, they are very naturally letting go. I mean, they stop eating and they stop drinking because their body doesn't need it anymore. So to force liquid and food because you feel they need to eat, that's not very helpful. And so similarly, you know, to force them to, unless they have a long life ahead of them, then they need to force themselves to eat. Okay. Okay. he's recovering, so. You know, the body shuts down naturally. The senses absorb naturally. To try and get somebody to re-engage their senses when they need to focus on their own internal process, I don't think that's helpful. You know, I think if it's way before somebody's dying and they're a little bit stressed or anxious, then music can help them relax, or something familiar can help them relax. But at the time when death is quite imminent, we need to back away and let them go. That's my opinion. You know, if you're a Dharma friend to somebody, at that time, you know, you might show them a picture of the Buddha or of their spiritual mentor, or chant some mantra. If you're doing something that accords with that person's spiritual path, that thing is very useful. Yeah? Because, I mean, you might be chanting mantra. If the person's a Christian, you might be saying some Christian prayer, or, you know, whatever it is. That's useful for that person. That's useful for the person because it's steering their thoughts in a beneficial direction. But that's very different than just bringing in their favorite incense to try and get them re-engaged again.
Well, I'm just going to say the goal in that generally isn't to re-engage them. Mm-hmm. It's to help people just to be comfortable.
Yeah.
That last part of their life. And to, as you were talking about, either singing, they might, if they're Christian, they might be singing some hymns or doing things like that. I don't see it as re-engaging them.
Right.
It's more like just creating a comfortable atmosphere.
Right. And that's the distinction I was trying to make, is if you're doing something religious, that's creating a comfortable atmosphere and guiding the person's mind. If you're just playing their favorite music, that's not necessarily going to help them relax. That might create a lot of attachment and make the death process more difficult. So there's a difference between, you know, spiritual things and then just worldly engagement of the senses.
Mm-hmm. What about, you hear about a child who has drowned, and after a half hour they bring them back, and how wonderful it is that they're alive, and yet they spend their life with no, essentially not being able to think, they're being tube-fed, and I've taken care of children like this.
Yeah.
That has always bothered me. And every time I see see it on television. You know, it was miraculous after 30 minutes, and then I wondered what type of a life they had. Is that because of the karma they had before?
Okay, so a situation where a child is injured or drowned or something like that, they're able to save that child's life, but the child has brain damage because of it. Okay, so your question is it worthwhile to save that child's life? I think life is precious, and if the opportunity to save somebody's life is there, we should take that opportunity. Okay? And then, you know, you have to live with it. The difficult thing comes when we're talking about how do we allocate resources, limited resources. Is it more useful as a society to put the limited resources to in health prevention or in taking care of somebody who has no quality of life? That's where the difficult decisions come. Okay? So in those kind of broader policy decisions, I think, you know, putting it into healthcare prevention benefits a greater number of people. Yeah. But then the situation you're talking about is if somebody is drowning in front of you, you're not going to sit there and watch them. You're going to do something. Yeah. So I think one of the tricky things also comes in is if when somebody first enters the hospital, do you choose to put them on life support or not? Yeah. And so I think that's a decision that, that people need to think about very carefully. You know, what is the chance of them living if they're put on life support? And, you know, how else could those resources be used and, you know, all these kinds of things. And the bottom line is we never know. And we just do the best we can. But this is exactly why it can be very good to prepare living wills, you know, and advanced directives, where we make our wishes known. And we don't put our dear ones in the position of having to decide those kinds of things for us. How many of you have advanced directives? Oh, wow, quite a number of you do. The people who don't, I would really recommend doing that. I think it's kindness to your family and your dear ones, you know, to express what you want to happen to you in these kinds of situations, so that they don't have to make the decisions.
I'd like to just follow up on that, because this is a very important point, I think. I've seen and been involved in situations where the power of attorney, the durable power of attorney, was given to someone that had a lot of attachment to the person dying. And so the person had a DNR, do not resuscitate, but the attached person was the one that made the decision and decided, no, I want to save.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very, very bad situation. I think you really have to give a lot of thought to putting that power into the hands of someone that's going to follow what your wishes are.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good point, that when you make a power of attorney, to put it in the power in the hands of somebody who is going to follow your wishes, and that person may not be the person who is closest to you, because the person who's closest to you they want at all costs for you to live, and they may not follow your wishes. Yeah. And when we sat down as an Abbey community, and we did this a while ago, and we all wrote out our advanced directives, and we included in them spiritually what we wanted to happen, you know. And I think this is just as important, if not more important, than what we want to happen with our body, okay? But who we want to be notified, what kind of practices we want done, what kind of things we don't want done, you know, I think it's very important to let the people around us know that so that they can take care in that way.
I got in some conflict with my friend's family because they wanted to call the mortuary right away. I mean, you know, the body was out of there so fast I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
And I wanted, you know, I knew that she needed to be there longer. Of course, they stalled, so I did have a little more time, but not as much as, you know,
yeah,
before removing the body.
Yeah. And that's why it's important that we write down what we want to happen. Yeah, and we give it to somebody who we believe will follow through with that, you know, even when the body dies, how long to leave it. Yeah.
I think traditionally it's 3 days that you want the body left undisturbed, but the people who need the eyes are calling you within 10 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Or six, or whatever, saying, you know, we need these eyes and they're viable. The
right. Okay.
So what does that do? Well.
Okay. So we're getting. Actually, we're going to have to stop because it's dinner time. But let me just address that question. So, you know, if you've decided to give any of your organs, you know, for and do organ donation, then they are going to take your organs immediately when your breath or heart stops. Mm-hmm. And so you just have to be aware of that if you decide to do that. Okay? You can't do the waiting three days period. You know, that's not going to work. Okay? And also, not everybody stays in their body 3 days. So, you know, if the body starts to decay, then the consciousness is left. So it's not necessarily always to keep it 3 days. But, you know, three days, unless it starts to decay, you can tell, you know, if there's signs you can use to tell if the consciousness is left. Unless those signs appear, then you can take the body and move it. Or you just try and do the best in the hospital where you're at. You know, I was with one student who died, and he had talked to the hospital staff. We were able to keep his body in the room for about 10 hours. But then, you know, they needed the room to save somebody else's life. Mm-hmm. And so we, you know, did this thing of, you know, asking his, you know, the POA thing. And then, you know, they had to take the body. We didn't have any control at that point. Okay.